Hello, everyone, and welcome to Book Spider, a Book of the Week format podcast which considers the intersection of literature and technology, how those things impact the search for meaning in the 21st century, or sometimes we just bitch about a book we didn't like. Today we're going to be discussing Jason Green's Unworld, a novel which uses the techniques and style of literary fiction to approach subject matter that might be more commonly understood as occupying the realm of science fiction. We're going to be discussing our feelings about the virtues and flaws of Unworld and how it fits into larger trends, not just in books, but in storytelling media. But before we do that, and before I go into an overview of the plot, I just wanted to briefly introduce our hosts. I am the host of Book Spider, Hans Berger. I'm the gentleman who's running the show this week. I'm joined, as always, by Chris Malmberg.
Yo!
And Patrick Barney, who I believe had a little bit of log rolling he wanted to do before we get into the main topic of the episodes. Patrick?
Yeah, thanks, Hans. I just wanted to remind everybody, if you've listened to past episodes, you know that I have a story called The Servant that is being published by 100 Subtext Magazine. It's online right now, issue 36. You can go to their website. It's just 100, just Google 100 Subtext Magazine. And, you know, buy issue 36. It costs one quid, one British pound, 275 pages of stuff. So it's probably a pretty good deal if you like to read poetry and stories and you know, high level art type stuff. I also have another story coming out from Asterion called The Mirror. We're not sure when that's coming out just yet. I'll just pay attention to announcements if you're interested. And also, you can also buy my novel Gusano on Amazon. Gusano, Patrick Barney, hit it up. Thanks, Hans and Chris. Sorry to plug my writing.
Well, congrats on the stories, man. That's great.
Yeah, thanks.
Not as sorry as I am, but you know, good for you.
Before we start talking about Unworld, I am going to go through a brief synopsis of the plot, as we always do at the beginning of these episodes. This will be, you know, pretty explicitly spoilery. So if you do have any interest in reading Unworld, go do that. Come back and listen to this episode once you have read the book. I don't really know yet how Chris and Patrick feel about it, but it's at least worth reading, right? It's an interesting novel. And if you're interested enough in it to listen to the podcast, then you're probably interested enough in it to go read it and then come back and listen to it all the way. So the first section of Unworld follows the perspective of Anna, a woman whose teenage son has recently died in an accident. She has uploaded her personality to create a digital doppelganger of herself, called an upload. But the upload requests to be severed following the accident, and then Anna briefly restarts contact with the upload before it leaves her permanently. The second section is narrated by Catherine, a woman who is basically acting as a vessel for Anna's upload, who is now named Aviva. And for all intents and purposes, I suppose the upload is kind of functioning as a sort of a scientific ghost, right? A kind of free roaming electronic spirit. And Aviva misses embodiment in flesh, feels drawn to sync with another human, even though doing so will erase her. And Catherine, over the course of her section, is slowly poisoned by the mercury in her bloodstream that has allowed her to interact with Aviva. And as the poisoning is kicking in, she encounters Sam, who's the best friend of Anna's dead son, Alex, which causes Aviva to leave Catherine suddenly and unexpectedly. The third section moves into Samantha's POV, the best friend of the dead son. She discusses their project of filming a horror movie in which an evil spirit flickers between bodies, which would include a sequence which was similar to Alex's real-life death. She recalls Alex's unsettlingly close relationship with Aviva and determines that Alex did not actually fall although she's a little unclear regarding what did in fact happen, honestly, as was I even after finishing the whole novel. Aviva takes over as the narrator in section 4, in which she discusses the feeling of falling uncomfortably in love with Alex. She ponders the idea of whether or not Alex might have felt as though suicide would be a way of joining her in disembodied existence. And then she encounters a very simple, poorly made doppelganger of Alex in Unworld, the open world video game that he was very fond of, and ponders ways she might resurrect him. And the final section returns to Anna's viewpoint. We see Anna meeting with Catherine, who tells her that Aviva would spend time alone with Alex in his room and in Unworld, which is shocking to them, and that some portion of him remains in Unworld, at least some small aspect. She tells her husband Rick, they have a fight. She eventually leaves Rick. Sometime later, the four primary human characters all gather together to have a conversation at Sam's request. Sam apologizes for missing Alex's funeral. She states it is not Aviva's fault that he killed himself. Anna takes a moment by herself in Alex's room and reflects on her belief that Alex and Aviva are together somewhere and will come back to her. So, just to kind of start off, you know, I'd written a list of questions for discussion around this novel. And I really found as I was writing the list that a lot of the questions had less to do with the novel specifically, more to do with how it kind of fit into broader trends in how we address the relationship between technology and fiction, which I'm not sure why that is. I don't know why I had kind of like a little bit of a, I had a certain amount of difficulty thinking of things to say about this novel in particular, as opposed to kind of the broader question of how do the arts represent life in this kind of odd technologically mediated moment. But before I get into those, just to start off with, you know, Chris, what did you think about this novel? Did you like it?
I think that it started out strong, and I found that its structure and I think the kind of mechanical way in which it sort of framed the dramatic conflict between the characters didn't resonate with me. And I think that some of the ideas and themes that it's exploring are worth exploring, and it doesn't, so I think that like it's thoughtful, it's interesting. I wasn't very, you know, and I find these days, I think I've brought this up in the past, that like stories that have to do with the death or trauma to kids, I have a really hard time with since, you know, my son was born. He's 2 now. And so for me to not feel very moved by the dissolution of the main character's marriage, was it Rick and Anna? And Sam, Alex's friend who survived him, who saw him die, her trauma and Kathy's sort of strange relationship as connected back to this through Aviva, who is the digital twin or ghost of Anna. I just didn't understand that dramatic moment that we were building to. I didn't feel a connection to it. I didn't feel moved by it. And so I think that like there's something in how the different perspectives are layered and the way that we kind of cut through time and perspective around this tragedy. There's something in its construction that misses for me, but I did like the themes and I felt like it was very attentively written. I just, there was something fundamentally off with how these characters behaved and the choices that they made. and the things that they chose to care about and how they were responding, it didn't feel right to me. And I don't know if I can explain why. So by the end of the novel, I was kind of out of it, but I didn't hate it.
It's interesting that, I mean, I think if I'm reading between the lines of what you're saying here, one aspect of the point you just made is that you would expect to be more dramatically moved by a novel about somebody losing a child.
Yes.
And that's particularly interesting because Jason Green has, in fact, lost a child,
yes,
right? Like, his first published book was a memoir about losing a child. And so I think there's almost kind of like a, man, I'm just going to, it's so hard to talk about this without sounding awfully insensitive. And I hope, you know, you have to have a certain kind of coldness to really evaluate this purely, right? But it's like, it's always dangerous, I think, with fiction in particular, to conflate too much like authorial experience and storytelling authority, right?
Yeah.
Because, you know, it's like this, and his first published book was a memoir about losing a child. So it's like he has this kind of contextual, extra-textual authority as somebody to kind of talk emotionally about that experience, right? So it's interesting that that aspect of it, just as readers, even with that knowledge, really maybe registered the least for us. I think partly because, and I don't know if the two of you had this experience, but the character Alex, as he existed in memory.
Yes. Yeah.
Didn't feel like a real teenager.
Yes.
Right? Like there was just something incredibly kind of awkward and stilted and inhuman about the character, which I guess, I mean, this is a novel about inhuman creations in a way, right? It is a novel about computer beings. So there's a kind of thematic, accidental thematic resonance to, you know, the main character kind of just feeling inhuman and sort of like a construction, very much like a construction, but that I don't think that that's thematically deliberate, and it does ultimately undermine the emotional impact of the story.
That is literally a note that I made in the Aviva point of view section, in which we get a little bit of Alex and her and the relationship that they build in the short time before he kills himself. And basically it's the very beginning of that. And he's sort of interrogating how her memories and experience are synced with his actual physical mother's. Again, we're talking about a digital twin of the mother and a little bit of what is sort of fed into explaining his you know, death or is suspected as explaining his death is that they built this relationship and there's something weird about that with him building a relationship with a digital twin of his mother. And she's going into that, and that whole section where he's sort of like excited by how strange this is, I wrote that kid ain't real. Like this doesn't feel real, which I think is really kind of like, I think verisimilitude, I think that's often played wrong. Like, things don't have to be realistic for them to feel real. So that's an interesting thing. Like, there's a more nuanced question about like why certain things don't feel real, why they don't feel internally consistent or what is actually wrong here. Because I'm definitely not I'm not a prescriptivist when it comes to stories like cleaving to reality. I don't think that is necessary at all, but there's something about him that absolutely rubbed me the wrong way. So I'm with you on that.
Patrick, how did you like the book?
You know, before I heard you guys talk, I was going to give it like a 6.7 and say mostly entertaining, mostly interesting themes. I didn't have that reaction to Alex. I did feel like the mother's grief, Anna, her grief was much less interesting and much less well done than Samantha's reaction to Alex. Like, I found Samantha's viewpoint to be the most interesting of the novel. I could have seen the whole novel being like, I think the problem with Anna is like, something about her. I'm not really able to pinpoint why I didn't quite like her perspective. And I agree that her like emotional catharsis didn't really seem that strong to me. Like, I didn't like, Alex is dead. He's gone. He's not united with Aviva. Like, it, unless we're like, are we meant to think that Anna's like reaction at the end is just like false hope, or some kind of a delusion? I don't know. I really liked Samantha's viewpoint though. I thought the idea of an older teenage girl being friends with a younger teenage boy, like 18 and 16, not a huge age gap, but, you know, for some reason I found that dynamic interesting. I felt like I hadn't read anything with that specific, like, character dynamic. I thought that was interesting. After hearing you guys talk, I'd probably lower it to like a 6.2 or something, more flawed than, you know, somewhat enjoyable, maybe like a 5.8 or a 5.9, somewhat enjoyable, but more flawed than I initially thought. I also really, you know, I really wish this novel had gone a little more bonkers.
Yeah, I agree.
Like, I wish Aviva and Alex's, you know, bad digital copy in Unworld, like, Aviva had, like, done Alex's bad digital copy in Unworld. That would have been cool. That would have been, like, she just, like, in terrible grief, just, you know, attacks and has her way with this weird half doll. But more more bonkers in general would have been cool.
Well, just to kind of build a little bit on what you were saying, Patrick, it kind of wants to be both a sort of speculative account of the near future and a quiet meditative novel about grief.
Right.
Right. But because the grief at the center of it just doesn't land for kind of whatever reason,
right?
We end up with something that's like starting to be an interesting speculative novel about the near future, but that doesn't really have any kind of engine of suspense or engagement other than the ultimately, sadly, ineffective grief plot.
Right.
And that's probably, you know, the way that I felt about this novel is it was fine. I'll probably never read it again.
Right.
I don't know if I would read another Jason Green novel unless, like, if he publishes another novel and the reviews are great, I might give it another shot, but I'd have to feel like it would be a real step up above this one. It was ultimately kind of underwhelming and mid, and I kind of wish there were, like, 10 more like it, right?
10 more what?
10 more like this novel. Like, not exactly like it, but the 10 other people with, like, the chops and background of literary authors were kind of like trying to take weird risks to make a novel about the near future. I like that idea, but I'm pretty underwhelmed by this particular result, but I would sort of be interested to watch other people take a crack at the same idea. And I do ultimately, I think, in certain ways, admire it more for existing and being what it is than if it were, you know, here's 10 short stories about somebody with exactly my background, ethnic makeup, and family history, but, oh, it's not me, you know? or whatever, you know, any of the other kind of stock book types that you see in contemporary lit fic.
Well, I think I can, you know, given his other work is a memoir, and at the end there's an afterword, and he says he hasn't written like fiction since he was a kid. And what popped into my head was Charles Baxter's The Art of Subtext. There's a section in there about characters behaving badly. And what this novel really needed was characters behaving badly. Right. And I think that a memoir, when you're orbiting a real experience, you don't have that dimension to play with. So instead the work is playing with other dimensions, you know, basically like the depth of an experience or the interesting connections you make across time, or, you know, like the leaps that you take in examining grief. And I haven't read his memoir, but it got a lot of attention. And in fiction, you know, this is almost, it's sort of the other side to what I mentioned about verisimilitude. Like I was very guilty of this when I was still writing. But like trying to make characters behave like rationally, and then also have them generate dramatic moments. You get into this, I think, like little halfway space where they are, you know, ultimately what, you know, we build up to is a confrontation between all of the characters that I don't understand, right? That there's some kind of tension there, and Anna and Rick are separating, perhaps their marriage is over. But, you know, Patrick, your note was a really good one. You have this sort of untethered version of Anna with a very different relationship to the feeling of grief. And, you know, all this to say, it seems to me, you know, like I can understand where, you know, if I had been invited to give feedback on an early copy of it, it would be like, hey, some of these characters who've gone through the worst possible thing, they can, you know, they can do more strange things. They can be a problem. They can do something that is incredibly selfish, and, you know, and none of the things that are built up as selfish are, you know, the snipes that Anna and Rick sort of levy at each other. Rick says something, you know, he basically says, you know, maybe Sam was trying to kill herself and, you know, Alex tried to save him. And all of these feel like you're trying to kind of keep characters in a rational lane while they're playing theoretically outside of that lane in, you know, what they're thinking or saying, but they're not actually doing anything. And I think fiction, you know, you can have like the meditative fiction novel where, like, you know, Marilyn Robinson or whatever, where very little happens.
Yeah, the snorefest Marilyn Robinson.
Yeah, well, I fucking love Gilead. So,
I know.
But
I know.
But it does feel like you kind of have to be Marilyn Robinson to do that shit. And,
sure.
Green just doesn't pull it off. And I, there does seem to be options here for these characters to do very selfish, very hurtful things, you know, and they even have license to do that with this tragedy and the setting. Like there's, you know, seems like there's interesting opportunities for what that could look like. And none of that, everything's kind of kept very controlled. And I think that's what I'd lay as my explanation for why the grief just doesn't carry, because it's written more like a memoir, but it isn't a memoir. And there's something in that gap that doesn't work.
You know, often when I read first novels, there's a way in which you can just kind of feel an author laboring over the work of writing fiction, right? You just get a bunch of prose that just feels like fiction, and you never quite are able to step back from, like, the kind of, it's like minute to minute, you can just sort of see kind of the mental checklist of, like, is there, okay, little bit of character here, now advancing the plot. Oh, now, you know, I need to make sure that the narrator's reflection gives us some background about what's happened here. It's normal, I think, for any first author, right? And it's a shame that the, and obviously, you know, in some sense, Green is not a first author, but he said, as you noted, Chris, like, he hadn't written fiction since he was very young. And it has the feeling a little bit of like a really good second year MFA student, right? Where it's like there's a certain amount of vision and a certain amount of ease, but at the same time, ultimately, like, you don't ever really stop thinking about the fact that you're reading something that somebody wrote, right? It doesn't kind of get that. It doesn't get that kind of, like, it doesn't permeate through the wall into just being like art instead of craft, you know. And it's a shame that the incentives of publishing, for whatever reason, especially around literary fiction, are so set up around the big debut, right? First time novelists, and that's kind of, there's a lot of the time when I read new literary fiction that's like getting attention or that there's a marketing push behind it, it's first time author for whatever reason, it's just built into the structure. And it's like, I think a lot of these people, I had this feeling with Martyr by Kaveh Akbar, right? Another first literary novel that was much more acclaimed than this one and much more popular, but which, you know, just, I was never able to stop feeling a guy hunched over a laptop trying desperately to write good fiction, capital G, capital F, you know? And I think so many of these things are worked out by like a third or fourth novel, you know, but a lot of people don't get the chance to do a third or fourth novel because so much attention is focused on firsts. Anyway, aspect that I think the kind of fundamental inertness of the grief plot, another thing that does, I think, too, is it, for me at least, it resulted in me thinking maybe more than was totally helpful about the internal mechanics of the world, you know, and just kind of like looking for little holes in how the world building was set up and looking for little quibbles in whether, you know, things that were presented to us were logical or not. I don't know. Did you guys run into that as well? Like, how airtight and consistent did the world building feel?
I don't know if this exactly answers your question, but Unworld felt strangely unimportant to me. Yeah. Not the novel.
Agreed.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like, it's called Unworld, and yet this, you know, virtual reality where uploads, well, I guess not all the uploads have gone there. I guess that was just Alex's invention. But it was like, it's like, for calling your novel Unworld, Unworld itself is kind of a side note.
Yeah.
I'll jump in to say, too, that there is something very convenient to the way that Aviva feels grief, or at least as it's framed by Kathy. So Kathy, again, is a character who's a kind of professor, I believe, who's interested in digital beings, and so has basically created has augmented her body to be like an inviting, like, to be an invitation to these kind of free-floating entities that have been that have broken off from their human counterparts. And Aviva kind of inhabits her, and Kathy describes Aviva's grief very strangely for me, which is that, like, Aviva has, like, is a brain untethered from the body So she's not able to like, not able to disperse the grief, you know, through like her, the chemical reactions of a body. But that doesn't make sense to me. Like,
right.
Grief itself is a body reaction. Like, you know, emotions are your brain is basically using your endocrine system and the feelings of your body to communicate pain, psychic pain, you know, like you feel it in your body. And that struck me as like a very, just sort of an unfortunate, like, at least as I understand the science of it, really like simplification of sort of an intellectualized grief. And it sort of is I think it's, you know, maybe because the story has to be a certain way and Aviva has to behave a certain way for the story to work. But it feels like it's avoiding a much more interesting question, which is what is psychic grief and pain divorced from the body? And that's right. That's such a compelling question that it's sad to me that that is not something that the book is really invested in doing. And I don't understand really the point of, you know, I think it's just maybe an offhand remark from Kathy, and I was reading into it too much, but it drew attention to something about Aviva that feels unfortunate, where she's just really a second Anna rather than, you know, they have their differences and, but they're not distinct in interesting ways. They're just distinct in ways that make it impossible for them to continue like inhabiting the same body. So that was a big break for me in terms of like the world building, because it feels like that's, like you said, Patrick, Unworld is not as core to this as these tethered digital beings.
Right.
And they, you know, it felt like they could be more, they could be a locus of more complexity in the novel, like how they function, like what they,
yeah,
how definitely. They work and how they're not human, you know, and that's just such an interesting question. I was sad that it wasn't explored, at least in the ways that I was looking for it to be explored.
I took note in particular of that exact passage that you pointed to, right? Where Aviva says that if you're human, like you experience grief, but then your body begins sending out other chemicals that dull the grief so you can kind of continue living and it evaporates over time. And that for her, that doesn't happen. The grief just stays at maximum, you know, intensity at all times. And I just thought, well, wait a minute. If that's true of grief, like what if your upload has a really good peanut butter cookie, right?
Right.
And uploads the memory of, man, that peanut butter cookie was great. I really want another peanut butter cookie. Aren't you just going to always be obsessed with peanut butter cookies all the time?
Right.
By the same principle?
Yeah.
So then, you know, if you take that to its logical, if you basically follow that in any kind of reasonably logical way, as opposed to a plot service way, the uploads would be fucking crazy because they would have 100 different, like everything anyone has ever felt, they would feel at maximum strength all the time, right? So she would be both deeply, consumingly, cavernously grievous and also just astonishingly fixated on wanting a motherfucking peanut butter cookie. And that is interesting. I like that, right? That actually would be, you know, you were saying, Chris, that you wanted these characters to behave in a more extreme, strange way, right? And I think all three of us wanted this to be weirder than it was.
Right.
And that whole mechanism of how they describe the intensity of grief, the infinite, eternal intensity of grief, actually creates a mechanism by which Aviva could be about 100 times weirder, more intense, less predictable, less like Anna, but boring, you know? Oh, Anna's pretty boring too, but less like just sort of like a mopier version of Anna that can float through space, you know? So it's, and maybe that's why it's, maybe that's why that line drew you and me both, Chris, because it's not just a plot hole. It's not just a clunky bit of exposition. It's a clunky bit of exposition that points to a much more interesting version of this idea.
I also want to jump on this and point out that this would have been a cool area for the novel to get more into the technical aspects of neural networks, because, you know, the novel just kind of glazes over the fact, well, these uploads are, you know, they go to, they're tethered to, not tethered, but they're generated by a neural network, right? And as far as I know, like what you said, Chris, about how the body, like the brain, the human brain creates grief, and grief has a certain experiential feeling. Like, you know, your heart can literally feel burning in your chest. You know, like you feel actual physical pain, painful sensations when grief is really strong. But Aviva doesn't have that. However, there's no reason that a neural network couldn't disperse a feeling into a body, but there's no reason it can't get rid of a series of connections that cause the grief for whatever reason.
Yeah, you could simulate the body either to feel it or to disperse it or both. It seems strange to feel it and not be able to disperse it.
Like you guys are saying, the exposition there is super clunky, and it reveals kind of a lack of a moment when the author really should have done more research on what neural networks actually are. And like, I'm not an authority. I don't really know that much about them, but you need a whole host of information that you don't share in your novel to make it feel like you are saying something real. You guys know what I'm saying? Like you read a whole book on something, you only use one or two things on the page, but you have that knowledge to kind of bolster everything up as subtext, I would say.
Yeah, I agree. And maybe we have no way of knowing that Jason Green didn't do that, but it doesn't feel like he
did. Right, it doesn't. We don't know that he didn't, but it doesn't feel like he did it. I was also going to point out that at one point, I think Kathy or Aviva mentions that some programs have some of these uploads, these untethered uploads, have gotten access to their own code and rewritten themselves. And that's not something that humans can do. Humans can't rewrite their own DNA. But if you're a computer program, there's no reason that it wouldn't be possible if you know how to, you know, rewrite code. So I guess that was just another area where I felt like it could have done something really interesting to delve into how Aviva and uploads are non-human characters. That could have been an area where, you know, what if Aviva, like, tired of her terrible grief, is like, well, I'm going to rewrite my code so that I don't remember any of it and I just have an orgasm all the time. Right? Like, why not?
Yeah, why not? A few episodes ago, we read In Ascension by Martin McInnes. And we talked then about, I wonder if we're starting to identify a theory here of why literary fiction and science fiction, these things that are kind of like a halfway point between the between aspects of those two, why maybe those often don't work, right? Because I think what happened, and maybe this is an unfair criticism, and I know I'm projecting to some extent into the psyches of people I've never met here, but with both In Ascension and Unworld, you have this effect where the author kind of goes, okay, well, I don't need to, either in my research or in the writing, really deeply delve into or understand the technical aspect of this, because this is coming from a literary perspective, so it's more, what I'm doing is more about vibe and character, mm-hmm. right? But then, so they kind of excuse themselves from having the nerdy rigor that a lot of sci-fi would. And I say this as somebody who doesn't read a lot of sci-fi right. or have too deep an investment in it, but you know, you have these books that are about sci-fi concepts, but written without much interest in the technical aspect, because the author thinks of themselves as somebody that works on mood and character right. and theme. But then the mood and character and theme ultimately don't have as much space to develop, maybe partly just because if somebody had a truly like world-class skill set at mood, character, and theme, they maybe would just write something that was, you know, not inflected with sci-fi, right? So you have something that kind of is like in both of those novels, you end up with something that allows itself to where the hybridization allows the author to ignore or not put as much effort into what truly makes those things work when they work well, right? Where, you know, something like In Ascension, like the prose is fine, but it's, you know, it's a novel about space travel, so we don't need world-class literary prose. But then, like, the space travel is, like, not rendered in that smart a way, but it's okay because this is a vibes and theme novel because it's literary, right? It's like, it kind of, you end up excusing yourself as an author from the effort involved in maximizing the defining traits of either of those things.
Yep. I would say this novel's problems are the same as In Ascension's. And, you know, I also wanted to say that you were talking about nerdy sci-fi authors. You know, some of these authors are really bad. You know, I know it's not directly relevant, but like unfortunately you have like extremes like this where you're writing a hybrid sci-fi novel, but you're relying too heavily on vibes, and then you got the other extreme, like maybe that weird Robin Cook one we read
Abduction,
yeah, which is like so into the nerdy sci-fi, it's just so bad.
Sure, yeah, and I mean I know that there's I'm sure there's a great deal of technically focused sci-fi that is quite bad as writing, for sure.
Yeah. Right. I always you know, we've read him before, we've talked about him before. I always feel like Stanislaw Lem is somewhere in the middle point in a really good way, where he's able to, one of the few writers who's able to do the technical shit really well, but also have some really cool characters and good vibey moments.
Yeah, and I think with something like Unworld, and maybe to a bit of a lesser extent In Ascension, you know, I think what creates the idea in the market that there's a place for that sort of thing is less other fiction and more, I mean, I thought a lot when I was reading this about things like Black Mirror, right?
Right.
Or Severance, or the movie Her, which are much more like this in the sense of being very uninterested in technical details and very interested in vibe and theme, right? Using science fiction, using things that are maybe closer to science fiction, but to tell a story that's primarily interested in vibe and theme, very uninterested in technical stuff. And I don't really, I mean, Her is great, of course. I think Black Mirror is kind of overrated, and I thought season two of Severance was like very, very stupid, actually. I seem to be the only person who thinks that, but like, so, I mean, I do think that really dreadfully stupid. And I think in like 10 years, everybody's going to like, once the kind of, you know, there's some very skillful cinematic techniques involved in Severance season two, right? But like, once the shock of some of the cinematic decisions have worn off and people really start thinking about what's happening in terms of world building, character choice, like the actual answers to the questions that are posed at the beginning of the series, I think people are going to be, I think it's going to be looked back on much, much more critically than it was received in the moment, you know? And so, I mean, I think both that like Black Mirror and Severance have kind of created the idea in the marketplace that there's space for this, and also have kind of created a permission structure where it can make some of the same mistakes. But, you know, those shows have at least, Severance in particular, has at least like the benefit of being able to do production and cinematography in like ways that are striking enough to cover up the kind of vapid nature of the actual idea building, you know, and this doesn't have an equivalent to that. I wonder, though, this was something I was thinking about, and this kind of ties back to something I was saying earlier, right? I do think that, like, on a personal level, I do think that probably we're on the cusp of some version of most of what, like, most of what happens in the world of Unworld, the novel, not the game, right? Like, most of what takes place in this novel probably, I think, is probably on the horizon in the near future, right? And, you know, with the lead time involved in usually in writing a novel, when you start writing a novel, you're almost always, you're writing something that will be read. When you write your first sentence, you're beginning to write something that will actually be read in the world as it exists 4 or 5 years in the future, right?
Right.
So does that mean that if you are a novelist who is seeking to represent the world as we experience it currently, right? If you're trying to write about the life we live now, do you actually always need to be incorporating some amount of science fiction because you're essentially writing toward a future audience who lives in a world that will be notably transformed by things that are just speculation right now?
No.
Patrick, you say no, I think.
Not always.
Not always. I think, yeah, not always, because one, this is a glib answer. You could be writing a novel set in the past.
Well, that's what I was going to say.
Yeah.
Well, no. Let's say that you're not trying to write a novel set in the past, right? And this is something I thought about a lot when I was a novelist. I did not want to write period pieces, right? I didn't want to write a novel set in 1994. I wanted to write about, like, it felt important to me to have fiction that, like, takes place now and is about now and uses the lens of fiction to think about now. And I know that now is a slippery concept, right? But I did not want to write something that was explicitly, like, here's my novel about the early 90s or, you know, the 2008 election or something like that, right? Like, don't do that, right? If you are...
Can't you write a novel that takes place in the past that comments on now?
Yeah, you could. You could. That's true.
But I am being unnecessarily quibbly.
If you don't want to do that, right? If you want to write something that just takes place in the current day.
I think I'll glib comment aside, I think maybe you do, in for the most part, have to, I don't know if it's science fiction elements or what, but I'll say why. I don't think it has to do with, you know, like the book coming out a few years after you've started writing it. I think it has to do with how we experience, what our problems are today and how they play in a space that feels strange. I think that modern life feels strange in a particular way because of where technology is and how it intersects with society. where most problems of today at least have some sort of aspect that touches on how technology, puts its own kind of spin on that thing, you know? So like, I actually think that that's a relatively recent development too. I think it's less than 20 years old. It could even be less than 15 or 10. But we live in a time where we feel dislocated from a version of reality that, whether we actively are nostalgic for it or we've made it up, or whether, you know, it actually existed and was gone, I think that there is a sense of dislocation that technology brings that colors almost everything. And I think you can get away with a kind of a spare, sparely researched, you know, treatment on technology and still have, you know, still be well received, you know, by readers, because really what Unworld is doing, what In Ascension to a less extent was doing, they're less interested in like how things work, I think, to their detriment, but what they are getting at is how strange like modern life is. And I think I think it's hard to ignore the importance of that, even when you're talking about very mundane things. And I really do think that that is an aspect of being alive today, how bizarre things are in, you know, just everyday life. And that bizarreness is to some extent a result of just where we are technologically, and what technology has done to our culture and our society. Does that make sense? Like, I don't think that it really has to do with anticipating what's, you know, a few years from now. I think right now, like, we are all confronting a strangeness that technology brings that makes everyday life feel a little bit sci-fi. And you can write fiction that doesn't incorporate that. But I think that a lot of the success of, I would say, middling literary work is just basically trying to get at that strangeness, even if they don't do so as well as we would like.
I like that. I like that theory. That makes a lot of sense. I think about, and this doesn't quite track with what you were, this is maybe a different version of how to do it successfully than what you were saying, right? But like, I was thinking about, I know that we always, for some reason, always come back to using Patricia Lockwood as an example of good writing on this podcast. And it must be very tedious for regular listeners, but at least I'm going to go with a different text than we have been fixating on, which is the story that she published in the New Yorker a couple months ago. And so she has a novel coming out that is, I believe, a sequel to No One Is Talking About This. And in the excerpt that was published as a short story in the New Yorker, the family is on vacation in Ireland, and the sister has her phone with all the photos of the dead baby, right? And loses the phone while vacationing in Ireland. And that is both, I think, not at all speculative, right? It's very grounded in, it's both centered around technology as a plot and also grounded in a way that it doesn't feel like there's any kind of speculation needed to make that technologically centered plot work. And probably what makes that effective ultimately is just, it's a smart idea and the characters are well rendered and the central conflict is well done, right? It doesn't stint on what makes literary things good, and so the technological aspect of the plot can be limited while still being I think, both fundamental, feeling like something that could only occur in a relatively particular historical moment, and also just kind of compelling and authentic, right? So it's like, I don't know, like, I maybe I hate that the answer is just good, bro, you know, but...
Yeah, do it better.
Yeah. But, you know, get good, bro.
Get good, bro. Oh, that's so funny. That is so funny.
If you don't need to, if you can't get good, then
kill yourself.
Just don't do that. Just insert, get a little bit of sci-fi, like mystery, and add that to your like drama. Like, you know, Big Little Liars. Take the plot of Big Little Liars and then add a little bit of a, just a little bit of a, I don't know, a speculative sci-fi, like, they can reconstruct the crime scene mathematically from the whatever. And like, and, you know, you get a book deal. I really do think that there is, there's a kind of a craving right now for that because, it speaks to, again, just how, strange people find like today. Like I wouldn't consider No One Is Talking About This to be speculative fiction, but I think that it has aspects of itself that are the entire first half and its devotion to this stream of conscious, very shallow surf of, you know, the internet. There's an aspect of something there that is, that feels, I don't know, maybe informed by sci-fi, but I'm rambling.
What is the next book that we are going to read for this podcast?
Despite the fact that my supervisor, Larry McMurdy, implied that I'm a failed writer, I'm going to go with a suggestion he gave me. He found out that, like him, I have a master's degree in an English-related field. And he's like, oh my God, me too. This is so cool. You should read Charles Bukowski's Post Office. And I haven't done it.
No.
You don't want to read that? Have you read it before?
I'm sure it'll be great. I need to read some actual Bukowski to displace the idea that I have of Bukowski in my mind. I'll just say that.
He's kind of a bombastic, pessimistic, but also joie de vivre kind of guy, I guess. So Bukowski's Post Office is what we're going to read. And Larry, if you're listening to this, which I'm sure you're not, how dare you imply I'm a failed writer? How dare you? Fuck. You can edit that out. That was dumb.
No, we're keeping that. That was pretty great.
It was great.
All right. Well, you heard it here first, folks. Our next episode will be rooted in deep resentment. And it's going to be a resentful analysis of Post Office by Charles Bukowski.